erotic love, gift of God, question mark. This is obviously an important issue to all of us. We all have to face the issue in one way or another in our lives. We all are physical beings, and we have the capacity for sensuality and erotic love. It came up as an issue at Holden a few days ago in some of Mark Schwain's classes, and therefore it kind of percolated to the surface as an issue that we could discuss together tonight. So that's what we're going to try to do. A forum at Holden is not a lecture, it's not a class in that sense, but we try to just put out a few little pieces of information to kind of frame the question at the beginning and then just throw it open, and it's all of our time to talk together. We do think here at Holden that the best gift that each individual can bring to the village is the gift of their own hearts and minds and best thinking on complex issues of our day. It's hard to deal with complex problems out in society because we're all such busy people and we're kind of going along in our lives. But Holden is a place apart where we can come and talk about some things that are really pretty hard to deal with in a way that can maybe push our thinking ahead a little on these issues and make some progress and make us more ready to be effective citizens back in our own communities when we leave Holden. So it's a real gift to be here. And the main gift that we ask of everybody at Holden is the gift of your participation in the discussion. If you disagree with what's being said, then you're being tapped on the shoulder by God, maybe. I'm not sure about the theology of that, but anyhow, I think, by me, that you should contribute that thought to the rest of us, because we need what you're thinking. We need to learn from one another. So a forum is a wonderful place to disagree with one another in a healthy environment that where we can really listen to each other, we can hear each other, and we can discuss some issues. So this is a complex one. I think it's complex for many people because you have children that are facing issues of how to behave sexually, specifically, or you yourself are facing those issues. I'm a college teacher, and I know that the students that I deal with routinely have as a commonplace in their life that they have sex with their boyfriends and girlfriends. Now, when I was growing up, we didn't do that. And my children are getting to be teenagers now, and I'm facing the fact that I'm going to have to guide them as much as I can and as much as parents are allowed to through their sort of coming of age sexually. I need help, and I don't think I'm alone. So it's a good, the fact that my college students take for granted that they'll have sex, that maybe they'll make distinctions. They'll say, I'll have sex in serial monogamy, only with one person at a time. Or I'll have sex only with people I know I love. Or I'll have recreational sex with whomever. With the onset of AIDS, that's less common, but it's still being said. So I hear it in my life, and I know that this is an area that I feel is under-discussed as a Christian. I feel kind of bereft of wisdom. So I thank you all for coming tonight, and I look forward to hearing what people have to contribute to the dialogue. We have a wonderful panel. I will just briefly tell you who they are, because you basically know who they are, I think. Mark Schwain, who, as I said, is the person who started this discussion these weeks at Holden, who is the Dean of Christ College, which is the Honors College at Valparaiso University, and a teacher there, and Dorothy Bass. And interestingly enough, these two are married to one another, and they're going to disagree tonight. Partly because I asked them to. Dorothy is a theologian. She has taught at Chicago Theological Seminary. And is currently on leave from there and doing a research project at Valparaiso University. And we're delighted to have the two of them. And then Mark Larson, who is our photographer in the village now, is going to contribute something too. He is a professor at, let's see, Mark, I'm afraid I... Humboldt State That's right. You can tell I'm not from California. And he is an expert on the media, and he knows a lot about the field of pornography. So I've asked him just to give us to kick us off, actually, by giving us a brief definition of pornography as opposed to the erotic, so that we can at least clarify that as a help to discuss our issues tonight. And then Dorothy and Mark will each speak briefly, and then we will all enter the discussion.
I would have liked to have brought a slide tray of visual aids, but we're going to do without that. The 200th anniversary of the First Amendment of the Constitution is the first point, I think, that we should recognize this year. Because that has everything to do with your right to write, paint, photograph, and create erotica under our Constitution. That gives you the right to deal with the erotic in a public fashion. Up to the point where it crosses the line into what the courts have chosen to label obscenity. And quickly, we're going to attempt to define that as the Supreme Court has currently defined it. Anybody know the two elements of the definition of obscenity in, according to our current law?
Why don't you tell us?
Yes, I will tell you. One, it has no socially redeeming value. Therefore, how could it be a gift of God? And secondly,
judged
by the standards of the community in which that erotica or obscenity is appearing. Hmm. Therefore, we have a problem in our society in terms of what is erotica or obscenity based on the law, meaning that you could penalize someone for creating obscenity, but not, under the First Amendment of the Constitution, creating or consuming in some fashion erotic. I will stop there and we'll go on, because there's a myriad of other elements.
It's a very complex subject, but thank you for clarifying that to some extent for us, and we may get back to you for some more information on it later. Do you two have a preference?
Okay.
Mark?
I'll
Mark? Go ahead. Okay. Mark Schwing.
I've been one charged with raising this whole thorny subject to begin with, and so I thought I would say in a few moments what started the conversation. I tried to, in one of the sessions last week, read briefly a passage from the work of a man who is one of the foremost social historians at work in this country, and who has spent a lifetime studying matters of human sexuality, marriage, the family, over the span of centuries, and who is not known for hyperbole, that is, overstatement. He's known for restraint. But he argues that one of the most profound, if not the most profound, of social transformations ever to have taken place has really taken place over the last 20 or so years, and he is somewhat alarmed by it, and it has to do, really, with the range of subjects which will occupy our attention not only this evening, but inter alia for the rest of the week. So I just wanted to read a brief paragraph in which he describes what's allegedly our unique, unparalleled historical situation, and as I'm reading it, what you need to think about for further conversation is whether you think he's described our situation accurately. And here it is. We are in a unique position today in that society, through social security and other devices, has taken over the economic responsibilities of children for their aged parents. Contraception is normal and efficient. Our culture is dominated by romantic notions of passionate love, as the only socially admissible reason for long-term committed relationships, and sexual fulfillment is accepted as the dominant human drive and a natural right for both sexes. Behind all this, there lies a frenetic individualism, a restless search for the sexual and emotional ideal in human relationships, and a demand for instant ego gratification, which is inevitably self-defeating and ultimately destructive. Okay? In my own words, he's suggesting there are a configuration of factors, all having come together, that are pretty much without historical parallel, that configuration. The first he mentions is an economic matter about the family shrinking so that children have no longer economic responsibility for their aged parents. The whole factor of contraception becoming normal and progressively more efficient. So kind of a disconnection between procreation and sexuality there. The whole notion of romantic love, passionate romantic love, as the only socially acceptable basis for long-term relationships. And then finally, the whole notion of a natural right to sexual fulfillment. And he's arguing that configuration of notions is just without historical precedent. I bring that to your attention first to see whether or not you think that properly locates contemporary culture, but also to raise at least some cautions about welcoming Eros as a gift of God. That is to say, the cautions I would raise are, first, historically, Eros comes from a pantheon of deities, with Venus as the goddess of love and Cupid, or Eros, as her offspring. And the way Eros is imaged is, of course, as firing darts which wound and which then inflame passion, arouse it within the individual who's overcome by the passion. Cupid dispatches these arrows rather mischievously. Typically, the victim is overcome by a deep and profound desire for someone else. And that someone is more often than not, in the classic literature, not particularly interested in reciprocating, therefore the difficulty. Someone overcome with a passion, which seems to grow as obstacles to it arise. Absence makes the heart grow fonder. The love in the medieval tradition is especially passionate and erotic when it's for someone who is forbidden. So it thrives on a kind of set of obstacles. It consists of an inborn suffering, and therefore it's linked in much of the erotic poetry and much of the erotic drama and much of the erotic painting, not to life so much as to death, the Liebestod, the love potion, which the two lovers take in despair because they're star-crossed and there are obstacles to their love, etc., etc. So the history of Eros in painting, in art, and so forth, has a kind of underside to it that really does suggest that it's more often disruptive socially to human beings and so forth, in community and among each other, than it is constructive and binding. That's sort of one major thread of the history of erotic desire, how it's worked out. And so these are a few cautionary flags that might suggest why we're in the condition that Stone, at least, claims that we are as a culture. So I rest my case there. Let's be cautious before welcoming Eros as a gift of God.
Thank you. Dorothy?
Well, Mark and I and two or three other people in the village have been engaged in a conversation the last couple of days about which one of us would speak for Eros and which one of us would speak against Eros. And I am going to speak for, I think I'll change it now to the erotic or erotic love. I was of two minds about this. I have to say at the outset, I think that the feminist movement over the last 20 years has tried to look at erotic love from both sides, the erotic, I should say, from both sides. There have been criticisms, which I very much share, of the way in which that plays itself out in our society. And it's hard for me to start speaking about the positive without first saying that I acknowledge pornography and abuse and all of the misuses and the distortions of this, what I believe is a fundamentally good part of us in our society. The question for the church, though, is whether to try to, because of the danger, put that whole subject away, which I think has been what the church has done, or whether to try to help overcome those distortions, to see erotic love as a positive part of human experience, and to try to be a force within the culture to help it be fulfilled and full and full-bodied and loving as it can be. It's hard to improve upon some of the readings which were done at Vespers. Just to remind you of a couple of verses from the Song of Solomon, how graceful are your feet in sandals, O queenly maiden. Your rounded thighs are like jewels, the work of a master hand. You heard the rest of it. When we think of human beings in the image of God, the erotic is part of each human person. I believe that to be so. But what erotic love can accomplish is the recognition of the image of God in the other. The longing, the fulfillment of that image in the other to which we're drawn. And in this sense, it seems to me it becomes a place in which the fullness of human life and of Christian life even can thrive. We can learn and be in trust. We can rejoice and delight in that which is created in the other, and then reciprocally in ourselves. We can experience gratitude and pleasure and the fullness of our persons. I've had an experience with a meditation, I wish I had a copy here with me, by a peacemaking activist named Joanna Macy. Maybe some of you know of her work, in which this is an exercise we sometimes do on a retreat at my seminary. You get a partner and look at the body, each part of the body of the other person. And it's erotic. They're not our sexual partners, but it's a beautiful experience of appreciating the human body in its fullness. And think of this as a hand of the human earth, which can articulate, which has gone through an evolutionary process. And the love of the body of the other person, which comes at that point, is like the love which can come in sexual experiences, in erotic experiences, and the thwarting of which stops up a certain kind of love for peace, love for the well-being of other persons, which can be a beautiful expression of the self, but also a force for Christian good in the world.
Thank you, Dorothy.
Well, there are two facets, at least, of this question that have been, actually three have been put before you, and now it's your turn. So we welcome anyone who would like to kick off the conversation tonight. Part of me wants to say all this fancy theological language is...
I was thinking this is a subject which really lends itself to a more baseline discussion, not in an academic or theological. While those are important, especially the theological, it's like I still don't quite understand what the disagreement is between you, if there is one. And I would like to see you perhaps put in maybe a 4 or 5 sentences your basic view on some more of the erotic nature of human sexuality and what your view is on that, and so to kind of lead into a discussion, because I think right now mm-hmm. I'm a bit confused mm-hmm. as to exactly mm-hmm. what you feel.
Mm-hmm. Or what we think, or what we're pretending to think for the purpose.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
All right, let me put a very succinct line out. I would argue that eros is more apt to be destructive than constructive as a social factor.
How would you define eros?
Okay, and I would mean by eros this kind of feeling rooted in desire, a kind of ardent longing for another, which is there and even flourishes more if it's not reciprocated. I'm using it different from philia or friendship and other kinds of love, like the one you heard in the first text coming from John, which is agape. In other words, I'm not saying that love is a damaging social force. I'm saying that eros, historically, is what's behind the kind of situation that Stone here describes. So I'm saying that it's destructive. I'll put that.
Is that like sensual love? Like the, I don't know, just very erotic, passionate love? Is that, and you're kind of like against that?
I'm saying that to be overcome by passion to the point of suffering and being wounded and so forth, and often what goes with that is a certain kind of jealousy and so forth, that kind of suffering as a basis for human relationships is destructive. I'm not saying that sensuality is destructive.
Okay.
I'm saying that kind of
connection with pornography.
Well, that's the issue here. If I can be an intermediary here, you have a right to yell theater in a crowded fire, or
that's
fire
it.
In a crowded theater. One of those. No, it's against the law to yell fire in a crowded theater, according to our First Amendment restrictions. So the issue is, what does Mark choose to do with this belief in terms of controlling others? To me,
that's one issue.
That the issue?
That's one issue.
That's one issue.
It's probably not the only one.
But that's where I react immediately when I hear this position.
So you filter it through your fear that society will legislate against something.
Oh, interfere with my right.
Interfere with your right.
First Amendment rights.
Well, let me try again. I think that this sensualness and the passion, which often goes with what we would commonly think of as romantic love, an attraction to someone, a physical attraction to someone, is a gift of God in the sense that it is part of being human. But that, like other gifts of God, it can be distorted by injustice, social conditioning, and so on. But the work of the church should be to overcome those distortions and to enable us to fully express, appreciate, and take delight in the other, which erotic love can entail. And that taking delight in the other, far from being destructive, is a force for human goodness. I mean, is a force of peace and love for the world, which can, of which we should be proud and joyful, and in which we can take delight.
When you're saying take delight in the other, are you just saying in the opposite sex, or?
No, I'm not. I mean, I think this is something which, romantic sexual love, whether same sex or opposite sex, is probably a very intense, perhaps the most intense form. But I feel this as a mother for my children, their little bodies, and, you know, for people I've taken care of in sickness, you know, treasuring their physicality.
And that's just loving them.
Well, there's something passionate and physical about it, which I wish to honor. I don't know if maybe that's
I love my mother's aging body, and I love her just because she's getting old.
I think this is something different. I think this is, I think of it as specifically, come on, God gave us bodies that are capable of great sensual enjoyment with another person, and to some extent with yourself. And, you know, if God gave it to us, she must have meant us to use it, right? God must have meant us to use it. And so, you know, there we have it. It isn't as though God gave us ears and there's something wrong so we should cut them off. Or, I mean, you know, so there's, if we have something given to us, most likely we're meant to use it. And the other side of that for me is when I was raised up, I was raised up in a very controlling society, a Norwegian Lutheran Minnesota environment, where we knew the rules. And it simplified our lives in a way that we knew the rules, and we obeyed the rules. And we had friends who obeyed the rules, and there was something regular about our lives. And maybe that is a value in and of itself, that it precluded much sexual behavior at all. I mean, I think chaste kisses was about the extent in high school, probably. My mother was not allowed to wear shiny patent leather shoes at St. Olaf College because they reflected up. Or red dresses. And when I went to Concordia in Moorhead, we couldn't dance because it was too sensual.
But is the question then, should we have rules, or what are the rules, or
and what would be healthy and useful rules to have? Where is the course to steer? What are the issues? You know.
Can we imagine a form of Christian faith in which this kind of full-blown embodiment is celebrated?
And
not
I think
just
that's
for the sake of childbearing and so on, but as a form of relationship in which Christian virtue even can, and delight in creation and pleasure and all can be celebrated. Mm-hmm. Or is that antithetical to Christian?
It's utopian.
It
seems to me sort of utopian. In a way, it sounds like getting to a point where everybody's feeling the same way about this erotic love. Everybody feels about it in the same way. And it just kind of seems a utopian situation that you're advocating, right or wrong, mm-hmm. utopian nonetheless.
Well, maybe the rules vary in different settings. And so one kind of talk would be appropriate at Holden Village, and another kind of talk would be appropriate if you were traveling around the world by yourself, and another kind of talk would be appropriate if you were in a big city with your, I mean, I don't know, does your community or your neighborhood or your situation make a difference? If you're in jail, does it make a difference? Is sexuality relative in that way?
Isn't the question not so much not acknowledging that God gave us these gifts and these pleasures to enjoy, but under what circumstances they can or should be used? You know, whether or not a monogamous relationship is that, or whether or not there are certain other extensions of the sexual experience are obscene or not, whether it be, you know, the definition of that, because I don't think anyone can deny that that is a gift of God, is under what circumstances it's used. And are you saying that under certain circumstances that it's used, that would lead to a very dangerous trends in society? Is that what you're saying?
I guess what I'm saying, again, just to sharpen the issues, that the erotic is by definition unruly. Someone talked about rules. If it weren't unruly, it wouldn't be erotic. I mean, in other words, it would be foolish for me to try to set up a set of rules that govern your desires. The two commandments I've never understood are the ones that forbid coveting. I can see how I can be forbidden an action, but how I can be forbidden a desire has always been baffling to me. My point being, what arouses you? You find yourself aroused. Passion means that you are, in that case, overcome, passive. You're not master or mistress even in your own house in that sense. You're overcome, in a sense, by eros. And so it's by nature unruly. That's why I think that one raises flags of caution here as to whether it's a kind of unmixed blessing. It does not mean sensuality. Eros and sensuality ought not be easily equated. I'm not arguing against a great sense of the physical and relishing everything about us as physical beings. It's this unruly desire that breaks forth within us and that serves many people as the foundation for marriage or long-term commitments, which seems to me to be deeply worrisome. Much more philia and friendship and companionship is a basis for long-term relationships than eros, as far as I'm concerned.
Sometimes it almost seems like there's different aspects of love in the separate eros often sort of say that that's the one that's uncontrollable. So it seems to me like it has a place definitely, or sometimes I think of it like the physical appetite. You can have diseases like bulimia and things like that, and the same thing with sexual there, and I'm sure that that's sort of a period of sexual awakening, and the minister was sort of, seemed like he was saying if you ever have sex or anything like that, I don't want you. He was just very anti-sexual sort of message. So I've known a lot of people just from their experience in the church having a lot of confusion because at that time when they're growing up and they're experiencing their sexuality, they've had a lot of messages that it's not a good thing. Or so, and I think that historically the church has kind of had that position, and now there's a lot of reconsidering of that. And then I've also seen like the extremes, if you go to like what you're probably talking about in a civilization of sexuality is completely unbridled, it doesn't seem to lend itself to community or things like that.
Well, those are helpful comments from both Gary and David. Thank you.
Robert Bella in his book Habits of the Heart talks about the same thing as far as the whole idea of the American pursuit of their individualism is in a sense tearing the fabric of the United States apart, and in our individualistic quest that ultimately is going to destroy us if we don't come around. And some people might say, well, that's a bunch of fooey, or can take it really as something that is very needs to be seriously thought of and considered, and what we should do.
Mm-hmm. It's a wonderful book.
Mm-hmm. Say, Mark, I'm curious with what you're saying. Are you saying that the human sexuality then was not, when you say it was it's not a creation of God, and that Eros was really not something then that was experienced until after the fall?
Oh no, I didn't mean to suggest that human sexuality is not created by the Creator. I think that it definitely is, and that human sexuality as such is
but
a good thing.
The Eros aspect of it was not an expression of human sexuality then until after the fall? Is that what you're saying?
I'm sorry, the Eros part of it?
Yeah.
That kind of desire.
Yeah. That really...
I was putting it in terms of another set of stories, but I guess that that has been historically one of the readings which has led to the kind of problems that this gentleman just articulated. That it's precisely in Genesis 3 where you first get the desire shall be for, etc. In the naked and unashamed part, in 2, when you have companionship and unself-consciousness, that seems to me to be full sexuality, fully good, fully welcome, fully a part of what it means to be human. But this kind of erotic desire, which I've been describing, the unruly business, has been read, not necessarily by me, but by a number of powerful exegetes, like Augustine, who has shackled us with some difficulties, just as you're suggesting, that comes up in Genesis 3.
Was there a hand up here?
I think when you talk about the experience with the other as being the sexual experience, we run into a lot of problems with what you're talking about, because generally in the Western Christian tradition, the other is something that we want to control, that we want to conquer, that we want to somehow make fit into a mold that we have preconceived for it. rather than allowing it to be something spontaneous that happens of itself, and it's simply an encounter that we are open to, rather than need to form for ourselves. I'm not sure I'm taking this one.
No, that's an interesting point.
That's
One aspect to follow that up is that in a legal sense, then we have clearly defined obscenity or pornography as being off limits if it includes a minor, particularly children. And so we have control as a society over creating that limit as to what we can create in Eros, or this unruliness.
It seems that this kind of Eros that you're talking about is, in a sense, a desire for desire, rather than a desire for another person or the desire of that encounter with another person that is simply accepted openly.
That's
so
good.
That's like twice removing yourself from the situation. And I also have a problem with the talk of God giving us bodies, because it objectifies the body. It makes the body something that we inhabit, like Alan Watts calls it a bag of flesh in the Western Eye. And we can't really experience another person if we can't even experience ourselves in our own bodies. So the sexual experience is maybe more fully realized if we can identify ourselves with our bodies, rather than simply inhabiting some biological matter.
Interesting. Good. Thanks. Nancy.
Well, I was one of the people that attended Mark's session last week, and have been thinking a lot about the categories that he talked about. And I don't think my thinking fits into the categories very neatly. So I'm probably not saying what Mark's trying to convey, but really what I've been thinking about, which is something else instead. I thought a lot about this whole idea of passionate ardor, and about what it meant to be in the United States in the 1960s when contraception really took a whole leap in terms of effectiveness. And that was right when I was in high school, right at a very interesting time in terms of passionate ardor. And I think it's extremely complicated. The interesting thing that's happened is that some things can be done more easily, and there's less of a concern about procreation. But that just doesn't mean that then there's this wonderful connectedness and intimacy mm-hmm. that we all long for. And I think that my life, anyway, and I really can't talk about our whole society, my life has been dominated by a notion about passionate ardor that I think has been a tyranny for me. I really honestly believe that. And some of it has been very cultural. Think about the musicals that dominated my adolescence. There was South Pacific. There was Oklahoma. Now those were all actually my mother's favorites, but of course you know how mothers pass things down. My very, very favorite was West Side Story. Oh, you know, and so of course, what do? I marry some guy from New York. I might not be able to ever see again. And I think all of my life, I have longed for that moment that's on the screen. Life is not like that. And I think lots of people suffer from that kind of frustration. I really do. Married or not, couple or not, you know, sexual or not, I think there's something that's working in our lives that is not a very helpful influence in some ways. And I think it may even be a perversion of another kind of ecstasy that we desire that is in our relationship to God. You all know, I mean, some of you know that I've been reading Madame Bovary this week. Don't think this is all confined, you know, to the 20th century. That woman read these romantic novels and got involved in all these affairs trying to find this kind of connectedness that she was looking for, and she never found it. But her original experience of ecstasy was in the convent when she was thinking of becoming a nun. And she loved all that, you know, religious stuff.
I think that you're saying exactly what Stone is saying. That's what he means by relentless pursuit of a sexual and emotional ideal. Everybody waiting for, when is this going to happen? And then thinking that that's got to be the basis for marriage or other long-term relationships. But when it doesn't, they become disillusioned and things fall apart. That's exactly what he means.
Is that anybody else's experience in this room? Is anybody else? I take it back.
What? I said, are you talking about the or reading? that I consider in this is a distortion. I think simply by this repressive, like how many of us are here Norwegian? What did I call it? Dysfunctional children of Norwegian families. Right. This attempt to suppress always at some level this kind of attraction, this need to control your body, how your mind conceives of your body and others' bodies, and so on and so on. And that in that attempt to control and to repress is heightened this desire and this constant drive for whatever it is that that we're all seeking at some level.
Thanks. You had a comment.
I think in a way I've enjoyed some experiences of sexuality that have been, I think, quote, erotic or just very, well, in my first marriage there was times where it was just very, very exciting. But on the other hand, there wasn't, the man was not capable of, it was like he was capable of sexual type of love, but the normal Christian friendship love, it was, he didn't have that in him. And eventually, just that excitement and all the fire and everything started dissipating because the friendship love wasn't there. And now, like with my fiance, now we, you know, of course it's limited. I find that our friendship and our closeness is growing because we decided to learn the proper skills to try to become more intimate. But on the other hand, I think at the same note, all the excitement is never perfect. You know, there's always this thing, is there something always better? I mean, in your mind, or there's something, you know, there's always that deception. So it's like it'd be easy sometimes to say, well, I'm missing out or whatever. So it's hard to be sometimes committed and consistent. But on the other hand, I think if you could, that love, the caring aspect, acceptance, you know, it's like I want that for me. I want someone to accept me and in my imperfections. And it's like it's hard to find that balance, you know, with sexual love and having it mesh with the godly Christian love, you know, the kind that sisterly love. But I think, you know, there's a need, and sometimes I think it wrecks the erotic. Sometimes, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Well, I don't know. Mm-hmm. There's something in us, I think, for me as a woman, there's something in us that wants just this total wild animal. I'm not kidding. But then on the other hand, it's like we know that wild beast or whatever is not going to bring us that happiness that we want or that commitment or that that stability or the caring that's consistent.
Or the clean kitchen.
Yeah, that type of thing. You know, so it's like, I don't know, it's a never-ending battle in a way.
Interesting. Very well put. Thank you.
Speaking of sisterly love, it was meant to be a lesbian joke. I was just thinking, listening to some of this, I am a survivor of sexual abuse when I was a kid, and so for me, you know, that sense of passion and wonder and delight, there's also a sense in which a sense of safety and trust is very important in order to have the freedom to have the full access to passion. And that, I think, as Ruth and I were first together, and I was just, well, we're still wildly in love, which is wonderful, but there was just, you know, at first there was just this incredible experience of physical and sexual and emotional and spiritual integration in a way that was just very healing, and healing in a way that brought up every hurt that my body had ever known. Mm-hmm. And so it was very purging in a way. And I was having all kinds of sexual abuse memories that were just, had been caught in that part of my body for so long, and that, you know, that it was able to sing and weep and just, you know, depths of healing. And we had a saying that kind of was very helpful for me for a while when we were dealing with this. And we said, you know, the best way to have good sex is never have sex. Which meant for us that the outcome wasn't, you know, are you going to have an orgasm? Is this just going to be incredible? And, you know, but we are sharing our love and our delight in one another. And where that takes us is where it will be and take us. And we will enjoy every minute of that. And, you know, we may vault and come back, or we may just delight in being together. And that's been very helpful and very healing. And I think lesbians have an advantage that way. We're not as tied to, you know, the male ejaculation. I mean, it's our experience with orgasm is probably, we have more freedom with that. But I think that was very helpful to me as a survivor, to have that sense of it is a process, it's not a destination, mm-hmm. and it really is the wonder of the moment to share.
I also think we need to be careful about notions of the erotic and power together. Because our society has really wanted to wed sexual expression with violence to heighten the thrill. And I'm very concerned that erotic power is getting a bad rap by the wedding of those two. And I think that, for me, erotic power comes in its fullest expression when there is full mutuality of relationship, where there is a balance of power in the relationship and mutual respect. And so I think that a lot of the damage that you were referring to earlier, Nancy, may come from our culture victimizing women in the notions of the erotic. I mean, that the erotic has tended to be defined more along the lines of male expressions of power. And we have a lot of, you know, we have a society that has all kinds of fantasies around dominance and submission. And there are lots of folks who cannot feel sexually aroused without either fantasizing being dominant over someone or being submissive to someone. And I think that's about sexism in our culture and about sexual abuse and models of power that really are about power over people instead of the power of connection with people. So I would like to see Eros redeemed and free from the power over models and the wedding of violence with sex for greater thrill. Mm-hmm.
I would like
Thanks, Ruth, and thank you, Phyllis, for sharing that. That was really moving, important to have said.
I would like to raise a question, raise something that if you've heard a few words from a few people, words like control and power. I am involved in, have been involved in some 12-step groups, and some of the things we bring up is the issue of control and trying to control another person, which is something which is out of our control. I mean, I don't know, I don't have anything particular to say about it, but I'd like to kind of toss it out to see what happens. How does the issue of control come into this?
People have thoughts about that? Question of how, what role control has in our sexuality.
Could I give one indication of how society chooses to control what you have access to? Following up on Ruth, R-rated movies, such as slasher movies, link sex and violence, and you can go see that at a certain age, right? And the content analyses of those kinds of movies show enormous frequency of sex, violence, sex sorts of things. Far more than X-rated movies, which have erotica as the basis for the rating.
So, interesting point.
I mean, that's documented. That's a fact. That's an indication of how our society is controlling access to that information.
Can I? We don't have a lot of time left, but I would like to ask a question based on my being a mother of youngsters who are entering their teenage years. What do you say to your kids? Does anybody have anything wise that they can share with the rest of us about how do you counsel teenagers and young adults these days concerning their sexuality?
I think part of that should be, I think that's where the church isn't open enough, because I think that that's one place where our kids should be learning some of this stuff, and I think that they're real afraid to say anything in a church setting. And for instance, I had a share group with 12 high school girls, and I was with them once a week for 2 years, and it wasn't until a year and a half that they wanted to start talking about anything that had to do with sex or anything. And I know that that's because they felt uncomfortable with me. And I see that now as I look back, and if I did it differently, I would maybe bring it up with them because it would have been easier for them to talk about things with me than it would be with the parent or something, perhaps, you know, and since I wasn't at the church. I'm not sure where I'm going with this, but I think that I think it is something that's just not talked about enough, maybe, in the church with kids. But then you have to figure out where you begin talking to them about it, you know. And I know that that's a hard issue also. But
I suspect it wasn't just you that kept them from talking about it. I mean, it's hard for us to talk about it.
Exactly. Yeah.
So we typically rely on teachers and situations of health classes to sort of come up with something about sexuality and talk about responsible use. And it's interesting how that debate creates a lot of frustration and fear on the parts of both teachers and parents on what are they saying in school classrooms, because we as a church people are afraid to address it. We as parents are afraid to address it. And so we pass it on to the public school system. And it's that problem is just fascinating. I mean, why is it we pass the buck of something so sensitive and something so important to people? We were expecting teachers to be parents again, you know that old argument. It should be our responsibility. You know?
What do you think we should say to our kids?
We don't know anything.
I'm still a kid, so I can't tell you.
Aha. Auntie.
Well, speaking as a mother whose son has begun dating, I was most concerned in talking about relationships, and that in fact he was getting into something very serious, and that this could be a relationship, and I'm not just talking about sex, I mean the whole vulnerability of the person, that if there was going to be any relationship there at all, that there someday may be an end to that relationship, and there could be a lot of hurt in all of that. And that that there was a great responsibility in the kind of friendship or relationship that was developing with this young girl whom I happen to like very much. And I think that those kinds of concerns have to be part of our concerns about what may happen, you know, down the road in that. If we want to encourage our children to think of other people as people and folks that they may be in relationship with, we really have to be paying attention to that whole relationship, mm-hmm. and not just whether or not they touch each other in the wrong place or, mm-hmm. you know, connect certain parts of themselves in ways that mom might not like at this time.
I read something a while back by a German pastor, Walter Trobisch, who made a point that I thought was very good, and his was that the basis for really strong human relationships, one-on-one relationships, are several fold. They're intellectual connectedness, there's emotional connectedness, there's spiritual connectedness, as well as sexual and erotic. And his point was that the sexual erotic one is so strong and so powerful, it's a blinding light, it's a flash that so overwhelms everything else, that if that is the first point of connection with another person, that you are blinded or crippled in your ability to judge the appropriateness of those other points of connection with another person. Mm-hmm. And he makes a very strong point that if you can hold back on the sexual so that you can establish those others first.
That sounds to me like very good advice.
See,
very sensible.
That's my concern as a parent, is how do you teach a child the difference between falling in love and falling in lust? Mm-hmm. And because of all the movie stuff that Nancy was talking about, where the end is the beginning. I mean, they don't talk about, is he going to leave his socks on the floor, and what happens if I fart? I mean, it doesn't deal with real
which none
life.
Of us do.
You're holding all the time.
How do you teach a kid the difference?
Sure. No, that's very important.
Global warming.
Following that advice would be good. Scott.
Yeah. Some of you know that we, during the month of May, we had 800 teenagers here in the village, and we 200 a weekend. We commented that if we could bottle the erotic energy, we could shut down the hydro for the summer. But I think we've gotten ourselves in a terrible mess with this today. Because for me, the positive pole of the erotic, a lot of relationships wouldn't get established in the first place if it wasn't for that. And I think erotic energy is involved in lots of things we do, not just in relationships. Some of you who are sitting there are well conversed with ideas, and there's an erotic energy involved in experiencing ideas and where they will lead you, or in art, or in music. And probably some of the, when we've gotten to some new places, it has been in a sense because we've been out of control. We're out of control. Something else is controlling us, on the other hand, we live in a society that's learned about all this power that is potentially there and uses it to captivate us in a variety of negative ways. And I think if we could somehow get more in touch with the erotic, then it could be less used against us or less used, we would not abuse it. Perhaps. We're even getting to the point now in our institutions and in the church where we can't hug each other anymore for fear that the erotic is going to come loose in the audience I mean, I think it's a dastardly state of affairs that we've gotten ourselves into because of some abuses, obviously, that we're all now afraid of. And so it's, I think this issue is really, I hadn't thought of it until you really proposed this forum, but how central perhaps this whole issue really is to us today.
That's fascinating, Scott. You should talk some more about that at some point. It's really interesting. Somebody today told me a story that when their children were small, they walked around the house naked sometimes, and not all the time, and not on purpose, but if they happened to be going to the dryer to get their clothes, they didn't worry about whether they had clothes on, or if the kid walked into the bathroom when they were getting out of the shower, they didn't, you know, shriek and cover with a towel immediately. So it was sort of a natural way of interacting with their children, they felt, and their children have all grown now and seem to be perfectly lovely people, but the same man read the other day that is now considered to be child abuse. sexual abuse of children. It doesn't ring true to me somehow.